Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today and for the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be on location. I'm going to be at Stillwater, Oklahoma, at the Oklahoma State University campus, and I'm broadcasting from the station on that university, which is KOSU. So we're going to have a little bit of fun. And the first guest in this series of interviews and discussions and conversations is Professor Dwayne Gill. He's from the Department of Sociology at the university here. And he's an expert on disasters. Okay, just a great place to come and do a radio show and hope you don't make a disaster of it. Dwayne, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. Good to be here.
Now, before we get into Dwayne Gill, the professor of sociology and the expert on social impact of disasters, etc., let's talk about Dwayne Gill, the little boy, and how did you get from where you started to where you are today?
Well, it's been a long trek. Yeah. I grew up in rural Iowa, southern Iowa, on a family farm, raised by my grandparents. And I think being a little bit marginalized because being raised by my grandparents kind of had me get an interest in people. I remember as a kid being a people watcher. I just liked to watch people and see what they did. And I also had a great interest in history. And so when I got to the university, I went to Central College for my undergraduate BA. I shifted majors four or five different times before I finally found sociology as a subject matter that kind of combined my interest in watching people and understanding more about people and my interest in history.
Where did you start out? You see, you said you changed majors four or five times, which is one of the great advantages of a North American education. You can do that.
Sure.
You're not committed like I was at 16, essentially.
So I started out in history, and I was doing really well in history, and I took a psychology course, and wow, you know, my people watching and being interested in people just really struck me, and so I changed to be a psychology major. Circumstances led me to drop out for a year of college and had to go try to work and get money to come back to college. And when I came back, I became a history major again. I was still interested in history. So I went back to history. Getting into my junior year, I thought I might want to be a secondary education teacher. So I went into secondary education. I hated my first experience. The kids just ate me alive. I said, okay, I can't teach
your own
at the high
children
school
are
level.
Usually okay. Other people's children en masse is very difficult.
Right. So I came back and I said, okay, what do I need to graduate? And I'd taken sociology. I really love sociology. So at the end of my junior year, I said, I'm going to be a sociology major. And my senior year, I loaded up on sociology courses, just really enjoyed the coursework and was encouraged to go to graduate school. And I selected Kansas State University, just a few hours from home, received my master's there in 2 years, and then went to Texas A&M for my PhD.
Okay. Well, great school. Big school.
Big school.
All right. But then you were doing sociology.
I was doing sociology.
Okay,
by the time I finished my senior year, I was a sociologist.
Tell the folks, we don't have too many sociologists on this program. It's right there on the, if you permit me to say so, the fringe of science. But it's nevertheless, it's an important area because it deals with us as our societies, as
absolutely.
It implies. What's your definition of sociology?
I don't think there is a single definition of sociology, but for me, it's the scientific study or the systematic study of human groups and societies, and I'm particularly interested in communities.
So then where does disaster come into that? Because you're well known to be a person that likes to see the impact of disasters.
Right, right.
Why?
So
being
interested in communities, I'm interested in what happens when disaster occurs in communities and trying to understand the impacts of these disaster events and the process of recovery. How might we mitigate these impacts, keep them from being as severe the next time a similar event occurs? And then how can we be better prepared for the next event that might come? So kind of working through all those different phases, primarily, again, at a community level. How can we be better organized as a community? How can we protect our citizens better when calamity occurs?
So calamity in those terms is one sort of event, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and here we are in Oklahoma where, and I don't know much about this, but the Dust Bowl had to be a calamitous event over Huge. A long period of time. And so, therefore, that's not so simple to study as, for example, an Exxon Valdez spill of oil or something going in the Gulf or even a nuclear explosion over Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. Do you study internationally or are you really concentrating on North America because that's where you can have an understanding of the social fabric?
Right. The bulk of my work is in North America, primarily the United States and Canada. It's not that I'm not interested in international events. I am, and I do read the literature covering the international events. But where I feel like I'm able to apply my research skills and kind of satisfy my interests is, again, more locally in the U.S. And when we think about Oklahoma, there are a tremendous variety of hazards which our citizens and our communities face. And so that is something very attractive about being here at Oklahoma State.
So let's start right there because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's important, I think, for universities, regional universities, to have something to say about their region. For disaster, you're right here in Tornado Alley. So give us some examples of, you know, very unambiguous disasters and how it's been reacted to by the society and how they've sort of tried to become resilient.
So resilience is the big buzzword in disaster research and disaster planning today. And resilience basically looks at the issue of being able to absorb the impact of an event and rebound from the impacts of that event. So in Oklahoma, as you rightly pointed out, tornadoes are a huge hazard. It's something which the entire state is susceptible to, some areas more so than others. And some of the resilient activities that have taken place, particularly after the Moore tornado a few years ago.
That's Moore, that's
Moore,
the city,
Oklahoma. Moore, Oklahoma.
Just south of Oklahoma City.
Correct.
Okay.
Some of the initiatives that came after that were pushes for more safe rooms or more underground shelters to protect people when tornadoes come. Can we seek shelter to protect life? And so one of the things we've observed after the Moore, Oklahoma tornadoes was an increase in programs to encourage citizens to build safe rooms in their homes or underground shelters. We also find a lot more emphasis on being able to support the underserved people in communities that are struck by disasters. So we know that there are some populations or some groups within communities that are more vulnerable than others, those who have lower socioeconomic resources to deal with. And so there's been an increase in opportunities or facilities to serve the needs of these more vulnerable groups when disaster occurs. They might need access to food banks, other kinds.
And these ideas were not out there. I mean, you said that you encourage people to get a safe room. Or,
right.
It reminds me of the 1950s, not that I was here, but everybody wanted the bomb room.
Right.
Right, you know, with dried biscuits and purified water, and it was going to last for a week, and then you could come out and all would be well. I mean, bizarrely ridiculous given the threat, right?
Correct. So, but tornadoes are different.
Yeah, right. They
you
do
don't,
go
you don't
away.
Have nuclear fallout to right. deal with after yeah. a tornado.
But
typically.
You get social fallout.
I mean, social fallout.
Can we talk about that a little bit in Moore, Oklahoma? What's the feeling of the people there once they've come back, they've recovered, and they're making plans, as you say, to mm-hmm. make sort of community shelters and for both rich and poor? But is there a lack of self-confidence about that comes into those disasters, which seem to be like rockets hurled by Lord?
No, actually, I think it's the exact opposite.
Great.
Instead of, you know, this notion of, you know, extreme vulnerability, I think people have this sense of we're resilient, we're going to bounce back. So some of the themes that occurred after the tornadoes were more strong, Oklahoma strong. Again, these kinds of slogans which capture a spirit among Oklahomans that, yeah, you can kick us, but we're going to get right back up and we're going to persevere and we'll bounce back bigger and better.
So, and I mean, that's a common phenomenon around your studies.
Yeah, if you look at Moore, for example, they've built back. The houses that were rebuilt are better, they're stronger, more resistant to tornadoes. So it's kind of that spirit of, yeah, you can throw something harsh at us, but you know, we're a strong people, we're very resilient, and we're going to bounce back, and we're going to take whatever nature throws at us.
So the new housing, is that actually constructed with the idea of a safe room?
Right. I think some are. Again, it's not something which is mandated by the government. It's individual homeowners' decisions about how they want to rebuild. And I don't have statistics on it, but my impression is that several of the homes that were rebuilt did make, within their plans, their building plans, some kind of a safe room or other type of shelter.
Right, because I'm thinking now about the recent floods that they've had in Texas and in the Miami area and Florida in general. And Iowa, you come from Iowa.
Correct.
I think there's a place called Davenport, Iowa, on the Mississippi.
Correct.
That perennially seems to get flooded, right? I mean, you live on this wonderful, mighty river,
mm-hmm.
and flooding occurs. And yet most people feel it's just not in their economic purview to get the sort of insurance that will cover that. And presumably insurance companies just wouldn't. They say, look, your house is going to get blown away again in about another 10 years. Oklahoma doesn't have flooding so much, I think. Are there big rivers here? Ignorance on my part.
Yes, we do have some flooding.
All right.
Down around Caddo County, which is southwest of Oklahoma City, there's flooding areas in there. Along parts of eastern Oklahoma, there are areas that are prone to flooding. We do have some flood risk.
I'd like to come back to that, but we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pennell. Our guest this week is Professor Dwayne Gill from the Department of Sociology at Oklahoma State University. And we're talking about disasters. There'll still be disasters to talk about when we come back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. If you're a loyal listener, you know I've written several episodes on Egyptian pharaohs.
Another one of your Dr. Death episodes?
Yep, but this time it's not about King Tut, but Ramses III, who ruled Egypt in its 20th dynasty between 1186 and 1155 BCE.
Ramses defended Egypt from three foreign invasions and developed industry and trade with Africa's Somali coast. The middle of his reign was prosperous, but later, corruption and instability undermined his reign.
That's when his second wife, Queen Tai, plotted to overthrow Ramses and install her son Pentuer as pharaoh. But ancient papyri document their failed coup and then trial. What they did not reveal is whether the conspirators killed Ramses before getting caught.
Ancient records show Ramses died that same year, but not how he died. Well, we no longer have to guess. Scientists recently managed to run CT scans on the pharaoh and a man buried with him suspected of being Pentuer.
The scan revealed Ramses' throat had been slit deeply and probably killed him immediately. Inside the wound, they found a Horus Eye amulet, a metaphor of royal power and protection, which embalmers likely inserted to promote healing in the afterworld.
By contrast, the second mummy, an 18 to 20-year-old man, was embalmed improperly and covered with a ritually impure goat skin, which scientists interpreted as punishment in the afterlife. His neck also bore evidence he may have been strangled. Finally, DNA analysis of the Y chromosomes of the mummy and Ramses reveal that they were likely father and son.
Another of history's mysteries solved. We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Dwayne Gill from the Department of Sociology at Oklahoma State University. And Dwayne, as we left, we were talking about flooding, and so it's a big issue right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you say there is flooding, and when people come back, they're resilient from disaster. But I don't see that we have learned an awful lot from flooding in particular, where the government doesn't seem to want to impose any rules, regulations on where you can or cannot build a house after it's been blown away with floods, or swept away, I guess is a better word. Tell me about that. I mean, that seems crazy to me.
It does seem rather irrational. But I think it points to something which a lot of people, when they think about disasters, don't consider. Most people think of disasters as purely an exogenous event, and the disaster is the tornado or the flood. Increasingly, social scientists are pointing out the fact that basic elements for a disaster from the social component, a social side of it, exist before the hazard event ever occurs. So the fact that we allow people to build in flood zones, we're setting up a disaster. The fact that we don't take care of our forest and rangeland and allow undergrowth to build up so that when there is a fire, they're a lot more severe, much more widespread than they might otherwise be. So we don't do a very good job of mitigating those kinds of hazards. So a lot of these things are embedded in our society, and when a natural hazard event occurs, things unravel.
That's interesting, because although they're mainly natural events, they're almost, you're saying here, man-made disasters. They've become an incident. Mm-hmm. And the disaster has occurred largely because of man's inability to think ahead and plan ahead. I mean, is that fair to say? They're natural disasters, but they're natural events that are made into disasters by man.
Right. A disaster is only a disaster because it affects people. So if you had a flood and there were no houses, that wouldn't be a disaster. You know, if there was no loss of life, no loss of property, no loss of resources, yeah, it would be an ecological event, right. An environmental event. But if there were no humans involved or not a big community involved, then you're probably not going to classify that as a disaster.
So
it's embedded in society, into the social structures and processes.
Well, that's right. So therefore, does the social scientist have a special responsibility in contacting governments or other organizations to say, look, you know, we understand a few things. So do you have a special responsibility? And how active are social scientists in trying to get policy put into place to mitigate the man-made aspect of the disasters?
There's a broad range. So you have some social scientists who are primarily interested in the science itself. You have other social scientists who are interested in the science, but also how can you do out with the findings? How can we go out and influence policy or influence the way in which communities organize themselves to be better prepared to respond to disasters? There's a really good mix. I think the key for me is certainly to understand the science and conduct good science, good social science on what we can find out about disasters and how communities can be better prepared. But it's also important to work with emergency managers in communities and work with policymakers, both at the state and federal level, so that they can use our scientific findings to make better policies, to do better planning, and come up with better mitigation strategies.
Do you find them receptive to the intercession of the social scientist? Do you meet resistance when you guys try to have an impact?
I would say that at the local level, we're generally accepted. When you move further up at the state and federal level, you get a lot more politics coming into play. And you're dealing with a lot more political power, a lot more resources at stake. Where do you invest those resources? How do you invest those resources in terms of disaster planning and mitigation? And when you get at that level, then it becomes more of a political football. It kind of gets kicked around, passed around, fumbled, intercepted.
it's
we don't score as often as we would if we're at the local level.
Well, Dwayne, on your website, it's very clear that you've got a particular interest and a big expertise of studying the Exxon Valdez incident of 1989, so a long time ago. Why did you study that, and what have you learned?
So I'm interested in technological disasters primarily because, unlike a lot of natural hazard events, there's much greater impact on the environment. There's toxic contamination of the environment or other types of degradation of the environment. And so I approached those kinds of disasters more looking at the disruption between communities and their relationship with the environment. So, for example, in the case of the Exxon Valdez in Prince William Sound, Alaska, we did most of our research in the community of Cordova, Alaska, which is primarily a commercial fishing community. So there weren't any houses destroyed by the Exxon Valdez, or there weren't any damages to the built environment, but there's a lot of damage to the natural environment upon which most people in this community depend upon for their economic, social, and cultural livelihoods.
That's why the village was there.
That's why the village was there.
Right.
Exactly. So we're looking primarily this relationship between communities and their physical environment and what happens when those relationships or those ties are disrupted or damaged. So to give you an example, the Exxon Valdez oil spill resulted in damages to over 24 species, animal species, in Prince William Sound area. The recent figures that I've seen show that only about half of those species have fully recovered. So 25, 26 years later, we still have several species that are not fully recovered from...
By recovered, you mean population
Populations
levels,
back in right. an ecologically stable manner.
Have any of them disappeared? Did the spill make anything extinct in that area?
We're not quite sure whether the killer whale pod has returned. There was a pod of killer whales in Prince William Sound, and I think one of those pods did disappear, but I think there might be... a new pod moving into the area.
Okay.
But
a pod, for those of us that don't know, is just a family or a collection
family.
Of families?
Right.
How
right.
many in a pod?
I think the one that disappeared had about seven or eight
okay.
members
right.
in that.
So it's a family, effectively.
Family,
right.
small group.
But I do read that herring, for example, not that I'm not expert on herring, but the herring does not seem to have returned.
Right. The herring population collapsed a couple of years after the Exxon Valdez occurred. There's lots of scientific dispute about what the cause of the herring collapse is, but we've not had a commercial herring fishing season in Cordova, I think, since 1993. So
that's quite a long time.
And this is really important because the herring fishery accounted for about one-third of the local economy in Cordova. So when you remove one-third of the local economy... That's not just fishing, but fish processors, cannery workers, people who right. work to maintain the boats. I mean, it's a fully integrated industry. And when you take out one-third of the economy and there's really nothing to replace it, and it hasn't been replaced, you can see a lot of community damage.
My good friend Russ Chianelli, who worked on the cleanup of the Exxon Valdez, the bio portions of that anyway, tells me that but the salmon crop, if you like, has just been magnificent. Any relationship, and is that fortuitous also?
I don't know the science behind that.
Okay,
I do know what the people in Cordova have told me. So there was a rebound and pink salmon, and then there was a few years of decline. And I think right now it's kind of the salmon fishery, pink, red, king, silver, there's four different major species that are of the commercial interest, have pretty much rebounded and pretty much back to where they were pre-1989
okay.
levels. But again, it's the herring that is a real problem in this community. And most people feel it is a result of the Exxon Valdez. Maybe not 100% attributed to the Exxon Valdez. There's certainly ecological factors, global warming, other kinds of things that might
account for it. Oh, it's nice to hear the words global warming in Oklahoma.
Or climate change, I should.
You actually said it, Dwayne Gill. We've got not much time left, but
sure.
let's go to, okay, we see a decline in herring, we see a stabilization of the salmon, all four species, which I didn't know there were four. What about the population of the actual villages and the towns? I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Is it been depleted in terms of the human populations?
There's been a turnover, and there's been a shift in sociocultural patterns within Cordova. So before the the Exxon Valdez, the commercial fishing season, and by the way, probably about half of the commercial fishermen are seasonal, so they don't live in Cordova year-round. They come up for the fishing season, then go back to the lower 48, other places to live during the wintertime. So before
but the canning and the processing,
all
that's
takes
permanently
place in Cordova.
There.
Right.
So, I mean, is how's that been impacted?
Well, before the spill, the herring season would begin late February. People would come back. They would start getting their boats ready, and the herring season would begin in March. So there's got this period of activity before herring season, lots of buildup, lots of excitement. You go in March, and a good herring fisherman could probably gross $500,000 in a week. That $500,000, now you got a lot of payouts.
I was going to say, we were in the wrong career.
You got to pay for your permit, you got to pay for your boat, but it gives you a good pool of money then to go into your salmon fisheries, which began in mid-May. Okay, with the collapse of the herring, people are not coming back to start fishing until early May. So you've lost about 2 or 3 months of interaction within the community because these people aren't coming back. And they're also leaving earlier.
All right.
Okay, so the herring season are the commercial fishing season has been condensed from about 5 months to 3 months. And that has a tremendous impact on the social interactions within the community. So there's been some really sociocultural loss in the community.
Can you see in those same areas an increase in alcoholism, an increase in crime? I mean, a big disintegration of what we call the normal social fabric?
True. So not so much now, 25 years later, but immediately after and in the 5 or 6 years, there were documented increases in drug and alcohol abuse, lots of domestic abuse kinds of
the
increases.
The usual things when there's big social pressure.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing is it really split families as well. Because one of the things that happened after the Exxon Valdez, some people were hired to work on the cleanup, other people weren't. Some people wanted to, other people didn't. But it really created a distinction between the haves and the have-nots. And so there was lots of animosity. And I know some people who still do not talk to family members because of the decisions that they made to either work on or not work on the oil spill in 1989. So 25 years later, we still have these fragmented relationships.
It's so disasters come in many forms. Some have more lasting impact than others.
Mm-hmm.
And for the reasons nothing to do with the disaster, just decision-making within a group of friends. You vote left, I vote right, and then you don't talk.
Right.
Dwayne Gill, we've gone through our allotted 28 minutes of Science Studio. I'd like to thank you for being here. I'd like you to thank you for saying global warming on the air from Oklahoma.
Climate change. Climate change is real.
Good man.
Thanks,
Keith.
I
agree. It's a great pleasure. And I'd like to thank Lauren Terrasas for putting this program together. I'd also like to thank Kelly Burley here at the radio station KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma, for hosting us and allowing us to put it together. And finally, of course, always thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week with another program, actually, from Stillwater, Oklahoma. So stay tuned.